Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
U.S. hiring is still hot, but there are signs the labor market is starting to cool. Plus, who has sovereignty on tribal lands?
I would argue that no one cares about it more than we do, which is why it's always particularly noxious to see comments by people in the state saying, well, the tribe just can't protect Indian people.
We'll talk about a key case the Supreme Court is expected to decide later this month. It's Friday, June 3rd. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. The Labor Department says U.S. employers added 390,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate held steady at 3.6%. But there are some signs hiring could be cooling. May's gains marked the slowest pace of growth in more than a year. Wage growth has also dipped from 5.5% to 5.2%. And economics reporter Harriet Torrey says retailers cut 61,000 jobs last month as consumers shift their spending habits amid soaring inflation.
We've had a string of quite weak earnings from retailers, and also retailers warning that consumers are becoming much more cost conscious. You know, we've seen very strong inflation in things like meat and groceries of different kinds. So now when people go to the store, they're really watching their pennies. You know, they're looking for the discounts. They're buying store brands. And retailers, their inventories were extremely disrupted at the end of last year because of supply chain issues due to the pandemic and delays on a lot of sort of holiday shopping. That somewhat reversed in the first quarter. So now a lot of big box retailers, big box stores are seeing that they have bloated inventories. And so they're trying to sort of streamline that and also cutting some staff as a result.
Retailers aren't the only ones streamlining. In an email to staff, Tesla CEO Elon Musk says he plans to cut 10% of salaried jobs at the EV maker, according to people familiar with the email. As Reuters first reported, Musk linked reducing staff to what he's called a super bad feeling about the economy. Tesla did not respond to a request for comment. In an email earlier this week, Musk demanded that workers at Tesla and SpaceX return to the office for at least 40 hours a week or seek employment elsewhere. Tesla shares closed down more than 9% today. Former Trump White House official Peter Navarro has been charged with two counts of contempt of Congress for defying a subpoena from the House January 6th committee. At a court hearing today, Navarro said he was arrested at a Washington-area airport and accused prosecutors of playing hardball. Navarro has been of interest to the committee because of his reports promoting baseless claims of election fraud. He also laid out a strategy for getting then-Vice President Mike Pence to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory. Navarro has declined to meet with the congressional committee, arguing that executive privilege protects confidentiality of some communications between the president and advisors. The January 6th committee will be holding public hearings beginning next week. And Boeing is pausing production of its Model 737 MAX for 10 days because of supply chain snags. That's according to people familiar with the matter. The company's factory output has been lagging in the past few months. Boeing's production and delivery problems have forced one of its clients, Ryanair, to cut flights from its summer schedule. Boeing rival Airbus is also expected to release final May delivery numbers later this month. The European airplane maker is putting out more jets than Boeing, but analysts expect Airbus to also fall short of production targets. Boeing shares are down about 30% this year. Coming up, how the nation's highest court upended the legal system in Oklahoma, and why it could do it again. That's after the break.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
One of the cases that the Supreme Court will be deciding this term is Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta. The issue at hand is who has the authority to prosecute non-tribal citizens who commit crimes against Native Americans on tribal lands. In 2020, the Supreme Court ruled in McGirt versus Oklahoma that much of the eastern part of the state would remain a Native American reservation, and that meant that hundreds of legal cases involving Native Americans could no longer be heard by the state's courts, as they had been for more than a century. The court refused Oklahoma's request to reverse that decision outright. But now, the state has asked the court to narrow its scope, and that has implications for both tribal and non-tribal citizens. Joining me now to explain this complex legal system is Wall Street Journal Justice Department reporter Sadie Gurman. Hi, Sadie. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sadie, first let's get up to speed about the issue of jurisdictions in Oklahoma. Can you explain the differences between what's considered the state and what is considered tribal territory?
Yes. So in Oklahoma, there are at least 38 federally recognized tribes, which creates sort of a jurisdictional thicket in terms of who is going to prosecute what types of crimes. The biggest difference between what is known as Indian country and what is not is that on Indian country, state prosecutors don't have the authority to handle crimes involving Native Americans. So things like murders and shootings and rapes that have been traditionally handled by local prosecutors in other places are instead handled by the Justice Department. And the tribal courts, the tribes have their own legal system, and they are set up to handle lesser offenses. Until very recently, Indian country was much smaller. It consisted mainly of things like casinos and government buildings. But the Supreme Court in 2020, like you said, ruled that much of the eastern half of the state is still a reservation. It's actually home to about 2 million people. So that, among other things, means that the Justice Department is taking on a lot more cases that had been normally handled by local authorities.
Sadie, McGirt was a big win for the tribal communities pushing for sovereignty. What did the McGirt ruling mean for them?
Yes, this decision really was a watershed of Indian law because it upheld 19th century treaties with the Oklahoma's five main tribes that were relocated to that state after white settlers drove them from their ancestral lands in Georgia and Alabama. That is what is continued to be called today as the Trail of Tears. Since then, there have been a number of moves that have chipped away at tribal sovereignty, and this decision restores that. But it also upended the state's justice system, as neither the tribal nor the federal courts had the manpower to accommodate the deluge of cases. So the Justice Department had to call in dozens of prosecutors from elsewhere to accommodate the new workload, and so did the courts. The state's Republican governor, Kevin Stitt, has been particularly critical of this decision, saying it sowed chaos and left crimes unpunished. And some violent crimes did fall into jurisdictional cracks, but the tribes strongly reject the notion that justice is not being done. I spoke to Sarah Hill, the Attorney General for the Cherokee Nation, who said what tribes want is the ability to make their own laws and be governed by them. And she rejects any notion that justice is not being done here.
We run a pretty good operation up here. I mean, we're not perfect, but no justice system is.
Yeah.
And everyone here cares a lot about this community. We all live here. Most of us are tribal citizens of the Cherokee Nation or of some other tribe. And so this work really matters to us. We want to do the best job that we can. These are my relatives. These are my, I mean, we're all tied into this community. So it matters a lot that we do a good job here. It's not like there are people up here who don't care what happens to these tribal communities. No, I would argue that no one cares about it more than we do, which is why it's always particularly noxious to see comments by people in the state saying, well, the tribe just can't protect Indian people. There's just no way, as if that we have less investment than they do in our communities and in their futures and in their safety. I mean, how does the math on that check out? I don't understand it.
So what Hill is really expressing here is the investment that the tribes have made in upgrading their judicial systems to accommodate this decision. And, you know, what they're trying to show here is that they are capable of policing their own citizenry. And, you know, it's been almost 2 years now since the decision came down, and law enforcement officials, including the tribes, are really sort of settling into this new legal world. When I visited Tulsa late last year, you know, I did not see signs of disorder and chaos. I saw, you know, what appeared to me to be a normal municipal court system, a lot of cases, but they were being heard.
So what changed for the state and for federal prosecutors?
Well, immediately overnight, hundreds of cases, you know, that were being handled by state prosecutors, things like beatings, assault, child abuse, were thrown to the Justice Department to prosecute. So dozens of federal prosecutors had to be called in to handle the workload. And so you have federal prosecutors and federal agents who usually handle things like counterterrorism and white collar and fraud cases in other districts who are now relocated to Eastern Oklahoma full time. And they're focusing on these sort of more traditional law enforcement cases that normally would have been handled by local district attorneys. I spoke to Clint Johnson, U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Oklahoma, who said his prosecutors are learning more skills, they're becoming more proficient, and basically doing the best they can with the hand they were dealt.
We were doing about 200 cases, indictments a year. I think for this calendar year, we're pushing close to 600. And so we've seen a massive increase in the amount of cases that we're doing. And because of that, we've had to have a massive increase in the amount of people that are in the office, attorneys and support staff and victim witness individuals.
So one type of case Johnson's office is seeing a lot more of is just your sort of routine run-of-the-mill domestic violence cases. I had the opportunity to sit in on one such case in federal court when I visited Tulsa, and I was surprised to see, you know, a domestic violence case being handled by federal prosecutors. But in that case, the victim was a Cherokee woman, and so it was sort of representative of the kind of cases that prosecutors are handling more and more.
Sadie, can you talk about what's now before the Supreme Court, the case of Oklahoma versus Castro Huerta? What is Oklahoma seeking here, and what are the legal implications?
So the Supreme Court, you know, has refused to undo the McGirt decision outright, but Oklahoma wants to restore at least some of the prosecutorial power it lost after that ruling. What they are asking for is the ability for state prosecutors to still be able to take cases against non-natives who commit crimes in Indian country. So what they're proposing is that they have concurrent jurisdiction with the federal government to prosecute these types of cases. And if that were the situation, it would be sort of an open question as to who is going to prosecute each case. Some defendants have raised concerns about double jeopardy, about being prosecuted by both state and federal legal systems, and people who have successfully appealed their state convictions after the McGirt decision and are now facing new trials in federal court, would they have to switch back to state court? Would state prosecutors charge them in addition to existing federal charges? So this has really raised a lot of uncertainty for defendants, and it's sort of an open question about how things are going to proceed if, in fact, the Supreme Court rules in Oklahoma's favor.
To expand on that a little bit, what kind of justice or closure can victims receive, especially tribal citizens right now, and how would that change if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the state?
After the McGirt decision, opponents of what had happened in that case, you know, argued that victims were not getting closure because cases that they thought were closed and adjudicated were then reopened and sent to different venues, requiring them to, in some cases, testify again or speak to investigators, sometimes years after these crimes had been committed. And so local prosecutors had argued that the McGirt decision re-victimized some of those folks. And indeed, you know, there were some violent crimes that went unpunished because of, you know, things like federal statute of limitations issues, or eyewitnesses died, or evidence vanished. And in one particularly egregious case, a man suspected of raping five people in the 1990s, you know, who had been charged by the state after DNA evidence was surfaced, had his case dismissed on McGirt grounds because of a five-year statute of limitations that kept the Justice Department from taking the case. So basically, he was allowed to go free without facing trial. Now, that's one of the examples that state prosecutors point to in an effort to encourage the Supreme Court to rule in their favor. But it's sort of an open question about, you know, what would happen to victims in those cases, you know, if their cases were then sent back to state court after being shifted to federal court.
And Sadie, the decision in this case could come anytime this month, even as early as Monday. Is that right?
That's right. The Supreme Court keeps it close to the chest as to when they're going to decide what cases, but it is one of the ones that remains to be seen. So we are looking forward to that in coming weeks.
That's Wall Street Journal Justice Department reporter Sadie Gurman. Sadie, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's what's news for this week. Our hosts are me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vargas. The show was produced by Trine Noree and Mohsen Ali, with help from Kate Bullivant, Anthony Bansi, Daniela Cheslow, Julie Chang, and Zoe Thomas, and editorial support from Kateri Yoakum, Michael Kosmides, and Chris Inslee. If you like what you hear, please rate and review us. We'll be back on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.